and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a raid by the FBI that took place at 4 a.m. on July the 26th at the home of Paul Manafort, who was Donald Trump's campaign manager and was present in the June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower, which Donald Trump Jr. set up with representatives of the Russian government who were promising dirt on Hillary Clinton to help elect Trump. Harry Litman, a former United States attorney and deputy assistant attorney general, joins us to discuss the significance of the raid in terms of the investigation underway by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. And since Manafort, who took notes during the meeting with the Russians and was treated shabbily by the Trump family when they disposed of him, might be persuaded to cooperate with the investigation, could he avoid legal jeopardy by ratting out his former employers, including Jared Kushner, who callously fired him? Then we'll speak with an expert on the North Korean nuclear program, Paul Carroll, who has visited North Korea twice and previously worked on nuclear weapons issues at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and the U.S. Department of Energy. He joins us to assess whether the Trump-Kim schoolyard exchange of belligerents with the bombast of the strong threatening the tyranny of the weak could get out of hand. And could Trump, who is increasingly paranoid as the Russian investigation closes in on him, and Kim, who is paranoid to the point he preemptively killed his own brother with nerve gas out of fear the Chinese might stage a coup against him, lash out with nuclear weapons. Then finally, we'll assess the possibility that there will be a fourth attempt by the House Republicans, led by the Tea Party Freedom Caucus, to shut down the government in October over the debt ceiling, as they have tried to do in 2011, 2013, and 2015. Edward Kleinbard, who served as Chief of Staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, "The Debt Ceiling Crisis is Real," and the likelihood that Mick Mulvaney, the Tea Party zealot who is now the White House budget director, and his boss Trump, could destroy the full faith and credit of the United States and take away America's greatest economic advantage of having the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. And joining us now is Harry Litman, who's a former United States attorney appointed by President Bill Clinton and a deputy assistant attorney general who currently teaches at the UCLA Law School and practices law at Constantine Cannon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Harry, what do you make of the pre-dawn raid on Paul Manafort's home by the FBI back on July the 26th? Two questions. One, how do you think that relates to Mueller's inquiry? And two, what do you think they were looking for?
Well, it's really significant. It's a shot across the bow. It's the kind of raid that one conducts against drug kingpins or other defendants, that you're concerned might destroy evidence, and B, as to whom you want to make a point that, it's a very disrupting event, and it really shows who's in charge. What are they looking for? Well, Manafort, it's been reported that he was in serious debt, $17 million or so, to Ukrainian-related companies, and that can be the beginning of any number of crimes, including income tax issues and false reporting as a lobbyist. So my best guess, but it's opaque, is that it's related to his financial dealings with people in and around Russia.
Well, he certainly made a lot of money out of the Ukraine and its pro-Russian party of regions. And he received $17 million over 2 years from the president's political party. And as we know, they found some ledgers in the huge palace that this crook vacated when the people rose up against him. So my sense, though, is that where he may have the greater vulnerability, or at least, the Trump administration and the Trump family may have greater vulnerability, is apparently he was treated very shabbily by the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who basically gave him 30 seconds to resign. He didn't want to resign as a campaign manager and was basically told in 30 seconds' time, the announcement's going out that you're fired and that we have a new campaign manager. And that was apparently quite humiliating for him. So do you think Manafort is ripe as a possible snitch, to put it bluntly?
Right. Well, and of course, the more immediate pressure of just wanting to avoid or minimize jail time. I mean, look, it was a very high-handed dismissal. It seems eons ago, but it puts you in mind of what happened to the Mooch and Renz Priebus over the course of the last week. You know, the inner circle of the Trump campaign and team tends to leave tire tracks across people's backs when they get rid of them. I think it's a kind of a New York style where it's almost a show of dominance, and dominance is a good in and of itself. Of course he is, and the bigger question is what he's in a position to detail. I mean, if you think about this, the logic of going after Manafort for these, for his financial possible misdeeds in the last few years, would be precisely the same as going after Trump himself for the thing that Trump wants to draw the red line about, which is all the financial goings-on involving Russia and I suppose other countries over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. So if he's in a position to give the goods on that, he's an attractive cooperator. More generally, I think this kind of treatment of a potential cooperator and the real sort of showing of who's boss has to really shake things up at the White House. The question now becomes who's cooperating, who isn't, whom can you trust if they've been properly counseled by their lawyers, and I think by now they have. Anyone who is dealing with the as a cooperator with the Mueller folks have been admonished not to say a word about it, lest they give rise to obstruction charges. And that means that you know, within this circle of the White House, it's trying right now to govern and deal with North Korea, et cetera. The levels of paranoia and mistrust have to be sky high. It's a crazy situation.
Well, this pre-dawn raid took place on Manafort's home by the FBI. It took place on July the 26th. But prior to that, on June the 27th, Manafort retroactively registered as a foreign agent,
right,
to basically justify the $17.1 million he was paid from between 2012 and 2014 for his lobbying work on behalf of the pro-Russian party of regions in the Ukraine. So what's going on there? That's a pattern in this administration, both with Manafort and members of the Trump family, and Flynn himself is. They all seem to, one, say they didn't have these meetings that the press reveal they had, and then once they're caught, they say, yeah, we did have the meetings, and then after that, then they retroactively register either as lobbyists, as in Manafort's case, or they have to amend their security clearances because of having been caught in, frankly, in a lie. So isn't there a pattern there, a pretty detectable one?
Well, look, I mean, it sure stinks to high heaven. I think people, their defense attorneys, will eventually be making claims about how busy they were and ignorant of governing, et cetera. But it was no secret that dealings with the Russian government and pro-Russian forces was a serious topic before, you know, by the time they took office. So having forgotten these sorts of meetings, these sorts of financial dealings, these sorts of lobbying efforts does seem highly suspect. I just want to add, having been on the other side, the prosecutor's side of some high-profile investigations like this, it so often turns out in these high-profile investigations that the actual story that emerges is a fair bit different from what the press is reporting based on, you know, snippets of discussions with insiders. So, you know, we should be prepared for the eventual story to be somewhat different. But I would agree with you that there is what seems to be an ugly pattern of, you know, convenient memory loss where the, you know, Russian issues are concerned.
But isn't there also a broader factor here, and that is that so much of what we're learning is coming from intelligence leaks and intercepts. And isn't it true that what happens is you get all this intelligence and then you sort of eventually kind of weaponize the intelligence into a case against these people? I mean, it has its pluses and it has its minuses. On the one hand, you may end up in a trial not being able to present evidence because it's classified. But on the other hand, is it fair to say that the process that we're undergoing now is turning intelligence material into criminal material?
So I'm not so sure I agree with the premise of your question, Ian, though it makes sense. And you're certainly right. There is a long, long list of rules involved in the presentation of evidence that has been gathered in the context of national security investigation. But it may turn out to be a lot more pedestrian than that, and you know, simple testimony that doesn't have special kind of classified information concerns. But look, on this basic point of the, you know, leaks of material, I have some sympathy for where the administration is coming from. I thought that the publication of the transcripts with the Mexican and Australian executives was really problematic, but they seem to want to use that cloak to cover much more political kinds of White House goings on that are not what I would consider to be, you know, of national intelligence gravity. And I think in general, it's quite possible that the evidence that you're, you know, that just because things were in Manafort's home doesn't, it probably indicates for that reason that they're not, you know, national intelligence information. And Mueller is well aware of the pitfalls here. I would think he's taking serious steps to, you know, build a case without trenching on the so-called wall between national security and criminal investigation.
So, but I bring that question up, though, Harry Lipman, because you have the consensus of all 17 U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia interfered in our elections.
Right.
And you have a president who's been denying it and continues to deny it. So that's why I wonder about, and you get these leaks of transcripts from the Russian ambassador cabling back to Moscow, talking about these people like Flynn and like Kushner, and those intercepts are pretty extraordinary that they've been leaked. I mean, that leaks, to my mind, that leaks capabilities. That tells the Russians that we're looking into, we've cracked their diplomatic code. So there seems to be something going
on. As is the June 16th meeting. I mean, this isn't anything that I'm no expert on Kremlin affairs, but there's only one reason to try to, or the most likely reason to be sitting down with a Manafort and a Kushner and a Trump Jr. is to try to develop them as assets. That's a terrifying prospect. So this may be presented in the courts eventually as matters of financial malfeasance. But the general premise of what Mueller's looking into, you know, concerns the kind of potential for compromise of national security concerns at the highest order. There's a playbook out here for developing someone as an asset. This is step one to the playbook. If that's what was going on, that's something that should be of enormous concern to everyone of both, you know, on both sides of the aisle.
And of course, you're referring to that infamous meeting where Donald Trump Jr. held in Trump Tower that was put together by this British agent of a...
whoever he is. There's a certain picaresque quality to some of these right. Matters, and he's one of them to me. I think it's Goldstone, how he figures in, yeah.
Right, and then you got the pop singer and his father, right. The Donald Trump of Russia, and then you've got Veselnitskaya, who turns out to have been the lawyer for the FSB. You know, it's hard not to believe that she's not a part of the FSB. And then you had a former Russian military intelligence officer and a translator. And what's really significant about that meeting was that Paul Manafort took detailed notes.
Yes, and that would be a big part of what Mueller was seeking. Now, of course, he would have had them already. Manafort is professing to be cooperative here, would have turned them over already to the House, and would certainly be turning them over to Mueller. So the aggressive play here by Mueller is to say implicitly, you know, we don't think you're going to give us everything, and we want to make sure that you know that, you know, we're in charge here. So they didn't strike at 4 a.m. in order to be sure they got the notes. They struck at 4 a.m. to send a message and in order to be sure they got other possible documents.
So what do you make of rumors that when Trump lashed out at his attorney general and humiliated him publicly for accusing himself, which is a very straightforward way of saying I'm mad at him because he allowed the special prosecutor to happen and I want this shut down. I mean, there's no mystery. Trump is not exactly disguising his motives here. He's not behaving like an innocent man in the sense that he wants this inquiry stopped, and you have to ask yourself why. Now, one of the rumors that I'd heard was that why he went off the deep end was that his lawyers told him that Mueller might well have his tax returns already. Is that something you've heard about? You know, it's a rumor, obviously.
Well, 2 points. First, it's not much of a rumor. I think it's quite likely that Mueller would be getting them not from Trump. He'd be getting them from the IRS, and he could simply subpoena them. I don't see why he wouldn't have them so far. But as to these comments, you're right. Trump is being positively imbecilic in creating a strong case of obstruction of justice against himself, and he's given away, you know, he's given the lie to his initial protestations of why he was firing both firing Comey and emasculating Sessions in public. And now the only, as I see it, on the obstruction charges, the only thing that's left for him is some kind of complicated argument that, yes, he wanted to suppress the investigation, but that was for good government reasons, like our relationships with Russia. I thought about that a lot, and I don't think it would suffice. But the main point is the one you've made, which is he's inadvertently and idiotically played an open hand that says the reason he's been doing these things is to try to shut down the investigation. The Sessions statement is going to be very strong circumstantial evidence about other things like the Comey firing. Yes, of course, that's what he wants to do. He wants to make this case go away. He wants to interfere in the administration of justice.
Well, Harry Litman, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Harry Litman, who's a former United States attorney appointed by President Bill Clinton and a deputy assistant attorney general who currently teaches at UCLA Law School and practices law at Constantine Cannon. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with an expert on North Korea's nuclear program.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paul Carroll, who's a senior advisor at N-Square, a new organization dedicated to nuclear risk reduction, and an expert on a broad array of nuclear weapons topics, from the history and current status of U.S. plans and programs to international programs and treaty regimes. He worked on nuclear weapons issues at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and the United States Department of Energy, and has a particular expertise on the Department of Energy's nuclear weapons infrastructure, where warheads are designed, built, tested, and stored, and he also is an expert on North Korea's program and the challenges to limiting it, having traveled there twice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Carroll.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ian.
And it's a very unsettling thing to watch, to see these sort of the Trump-Kim belligerence show, you know, where you got two very inexperienced, as in fact, as Joe Cerincione said, I think it was on Rachel Maddow, we have two inexperienced, impulsive presidents in control of these massive military machines. It's one thing to make a mistake intentionally. It's another thing to stumble into a conflict. Either one, Kim Jong-un or Donald Trump, could miscalculate and let loose a war unlike anything we have seen since World War II. Do you agree with Joe's remarks?
I do. I think the greatest risk we face is temperament in each of these leaders. I wouldn't necessarily say that Kim Jong-un is inexperienced. It's ironic. He's quite young. But when you look at the regional powers, you look at President Xi in Beijing, President Moon in South Korea, who just came into office very recently after a scandal in the previous government, and President Trump, who's the longest-serving leader? It's Kim Jong-un. He's been in this position over 6 years. So now that may seem a bit flip, but in all seriousness, he's consolidated his position. He's done some outrageous things to maintain that power. But, of course, North Korea is well known for its rhetoric and its bombast, and it's almost dismissed as playing to the world audience, playing to a domestic audience, and coming from a place of weakness. What's so disturbing about yesterday's remarks from the President of the United States is he sort of lowered the status of the United States by getting into the gutter with Kim Jong-un. And so does Donald Trump, the man, feel that he has to carry out such threats, or does he feel embarrassed if he doesn't? That's what makes this dynamic very disturbing. Now, I think people with cooler heads and with more serious experience with respect to military confrontation, and in particular what nuclear confrontation means, are near President Trump and around him. And that's what people like myself who watch this take some solace in.
Right, but we don't know. In fact, there's a real possibility that Sebastian Gorka, who is by any reasonable definition a Hungarian fascist, along with Steve Bannon, both of whom seem to have Trump's ear, there's some suggestion that Sebastian Gorka may have come up with those extraordinary lines of Trump's delivered when there was a photo op actually for an address on the opioid crisis in the country, where Donald Trump suddenly said North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. But there's another aspect to it that bothers me, and that is there a possibility, again, talking about this peculiar symmetry between Trump and Kim, even though one is the leader of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth and the other is literally a basket case nation, and as the scholar at Columbia University refers to it as the tyranny of the weak. But Trump is getting increasingly paranoid as this Russian investigation closes in on him. And we know that Kim is paranoid because he murdered so many people, including his uncle. But the most flagrant thing that Kim did was preemptively kill his own brother with nerve gas out of fear that the Chinese might stage a coup against him. So is that a factor? You've got two kind of paranoid people there?
Absolutely, it's a factor. And I think that's what I meant about temperament. Without trying to legitimize or dismiss, as you called it, the paranoia of Kim Jong-un or even I think more accurately, the regime in North Korea. If you walk a mile in their shoes for a moment, you know, the Korean War never really formally ended. And although I've only been there twice, it is remarkable and visceral how obvious it is. They are in a mental state of war. They are on a war footing day in and day out. And when they look outward, who are their neighbors? South Korea, an enemy. Japan, an enemy. China, you know, a frenemy. Not exactly pals, but they're sort of a necessary partner. And so it's not a surprise that the North Korean leadership may behave in what we view as paranoia, but, you know, it served them well. They have survived. They have figured out how to play that weak hand. Getting back to President Trump and who he trusts, who he considers loyal, and so on, that, again, I think you put your finger on it. That is what is disturbing about this. The tradition of United States government leadership, and in particularly when it comes to national security, politics is supposed to end at the water's edge. It's not supposed to be partisan. And now you have leadership in the White House that is hyper-partisan as ideological, and those that have served through the military bureaucracy, through the State Department bureaucracy, it's very unclear that they have any gravitas with President Trump. And so I think you've put your finger on it. The North Korean leadership certainly isn't suicidal. They understand the implications of going too far, but they are very good at poking and probing and seeing just how far they can go.
So Donald Trump tweeted out on Wednesday, after making this alarming remark on Tuesday, he tweeted out early in the morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Time, "My first order as president was to renovate and modernize our nuclear arsenal. It is now far stronger and more powerful than ever before." And then on Tuesday, he used the words not only fire and fury, but he actually talked about power. Now, there's a sense that there may be a kind of weird fetish with nuclear weapons that Trump has. He certainly has a fetish about bringing back coal, which doesn't make any sense. But I'm told that the first briefing he got in Trump Tower shortly after the election, when the State Department sends out its experts on all of the various theaters around the world, and this is a sort of ritual that presidents get in transition, just, you know, an update on where the world stands. And apparently these briefers kept being interrupted by Trump, who wanted to talk about nuclear weapons and what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. So do you think that there's something going on here? Why in God's name did he bring up the nuclear arsenal the day after he made these alarming remarks?
There's a lot to this, and I think you're exactly right. First of all, his tweet about his first order being to renovate and overhaul the nuclear weapons of the United States is simply fiction. There may have been something he did in his first week of office with respect to nuclear policy, but the truth of the matter is United States plans and programs since the Obama administration had been to invest, get ready for this, over the next 30 years, over $1 trillion to completely build new delivery systems for our nuclear bombs. These are the missiles in the middle of the country. These are the submarines and the missiles on submarines, as well as new bombers and gravity bombs, and in fact, even cruise missiles for those bombers. So renaissance sounds like a positive word. This is sort of a replay of the Cold War. We are in a sort of a Reagan-esque buildup of our nuclear arsenal that is not only unwarranted, it is dangerous and not affordable. Now, as you said, Trump's statements, not only with respect to this particular issue with North Korea, but on almost every policy we've seen, seem to go immediately to the end of the scale. You know, there's no gradation, there's no nuance in what he says or does. It goes immediately to, you know, all in. And so for him to talk about the power of the nuclear arsenal, which, by the way, he was inaccurate in what he said. We have fewer weapons now than we've had, really, since the late 50s. Not to say that they're not effective and highly accurate, but he's spitballing. And so a fixation about nuclear weapons, I'm not sure, but I think that he views them as, you know, they're the biggest hammer in the toolbox. So why not talk about them? The problem with that, well, there are many problems, but the biggest problem is there has been a long-held special status of nuclear weapons, a taboo, if you will. Nation states, responsible nation states that have possessed them, have understood the implications of using them, have understood that they're purely for deterrence. You don't actually use them like you would, you know, a piece of artillery. I don't think President Trump understands this. I think he views them as just another tool in the toolbox, so why not get the biggest hammer you can? And again, that's what makes the situation with North Korea all that more dangerous.
Well, here we are, Paul, talking on the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki, August the 9th, 1945, the last time a nuclear weapon was used in anger. So it's been a remarkable thing that we haven't had the use of nuclear weapons. It's something, frankly, having looked into how many near misses we had, and particularly the 1983 war scare with the Soviet Union over the Able Archer exercise and the Cuba crisis, we have come so close to, I mean, it's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, but to have one by accident. And there were so many times we've just dodged the bullet on accidental nuclear war. So this is not an issue of hyperbole, I'm afraid. The historical record, even though it hasn't really been properly released and put in context, indicates, and I worked at Los Alamos for a number of years and looked into this, we have a really hidden history of near misses, which I think the public should know more about.
You're absolutely right. I think there's two things to say about that. There's an excellent book that was published about a year and a half, 2 years ago now, by Eric Schlosser. So your listeners may know, several years back, he wrote a book called Fast Food Nation, which was an investigation and expose of the food processing system in this country. Command and Control, his most recent work, has also been made into a film. It was aired on PBS earlier this year. He does exactly what you just said. He has looked very carefully and, in fact, submitted a whole number of Freedom of Information Act requests to learn more about these near misses. And there not only are many, many more than we realize, but many of them were much more dangerous than we realized. The sort of 30,000-foot view, or what you might hear from the Department of Defense, says, oh, yes, there were what are called broken arrows or bent spears, but, you know, they were okay, don't worry. Well, turns out there were far more than we thought and far worse than we thought. And so there's that issue going on with any nation that possesses these weapons. I mean, keeping control of a nuclear weapon 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, something is likely to go wrong because humans are in the loop. Now, you take a country like North Korea, and you mentioned Dr. Sig Hecker. When I traveled to North Korea with him, one of his big concerns coming back is, you know, the North Koreans don't exactly have safety in mind. They don't exactly have the highest engineering and building standards. They are on a tempo of producing nuclear materials and producing weapons as fast as they can. So that's not a very good equation for safety. I'm actually surprised that there hasn't been an accident in North Korea. There hasn't been something, you know, that has maybe exploded or leaked, or and maybe there has been. How would we know? So you have that as part of the equation, too, which is very rarely discussed. Our own infrastructure across our country is leaking, and Hanford, Washington, for example, had some accidents in the recent past. We haven't begun to deal with the mess we created over 50 years, 60 years, producing these weapons for our own use, for our own, you know, quote-unquote, deterrence and security. So it's far more than simply the rhetorical standoff and the headlines of, you know, he said and he said. There are a lot of moving parts to this issue, all of which are potentially accidents or danger.
Well, just in the last minute, of course, all of those near misses in the nuclear age that threw the Cold War, etc., on our side, not to mention the Soviet side, all of them happened when we had presidents who, in the overall scheme of things, in the historical perspective, were sober, rational people. And now we have a leader that many people, including myself, really are very discomforted by. So I think we have a different situation with an immature narcissist, possibly even a sociopath, having access to the nuclear weapons. But just in closing, the analysis that we're all talking about, that the North Koreans have miniaturized weapons so they can put them on ICBMs, is coming from the Defense Intelligence Agency. It is an intelligence analysis. It's not a, it doesn't say that they have the operational capability. It's a big difference there, isn't it?
There is a big difference there. I think it's important at one level that we continue to watch this and that our intelligence community, as well as those of our allies, makes, you know, frequent and good assessments. It's important to watch that. However, it's not a surprise that that latest Defense Intelligence Agency report, you know, many feel it was a leak. You know, why isn't the Trump administration yelling about that leak? Well, frankly, because it serves their narrative. It serves their purposes. But it's not a game changer in terms of, you know, overnight the whole situation has changed. We know that they are heading toward more and more capability. And that is why, on the one hand, the clock is ticking. On the other hand, it hasn't stopped ticking just yet. There is still time for negotiations. And I'd like to end very quickly on it, on sort of a positive note. The UN Security Council, in fact, was in unison and is in unison on this latest round of sanctions. Now, there may be skepticism, and justly so, about Chinese enforcement and so on, but we haven't seen the Security Council resolution this swift and this severe on North Korea in a number of years. So there is an opportunity here to take advantage of that international unison and see if we can actually entice, coerce North Korea back to the negotiating table. But we have to have something on offer as well. It can't just be sticks.
Well, Paul Carroll, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Carroll, who's a senior advisor at N-Square, a new organization dedicated to nuclear risk reduction, and an expert on a broad array of nuclear weapons topics, from the history and current status of U.S. plans and programs to international programs and treaty regimes. He worked on nuclear weapons issues at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment and the United States Department of Energy. We're going to take a brief station break and back, assessing the possibility that there'll be a fourth attempt by the House Republicans, led by the Tea Party Freedom Caucus, to shut down the government in October over the debt ceiling. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Edmund Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, where he focuses on taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, he served as the chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Debt Ceiling Crisis is Real. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edmund Kleinbart.
Thank you, Ian.
And the debt crisis is not just real. We've already had examples of it in 2011 and again in 2013 and then again in 2015. So why do you think this one, the next one, in late September, early October, is going to be, I mean, the other ones were for real, they just didn't cross the line. But why do you think this next one could cross the line?
It's a fair question why this time should be different from the other near misses in 2011, 2013, and so on. In each of those cases, we had drama, we had a Perils of Pauline's, the sort of serial, and at the last minute, Pauline is always rescued from the railroad tracks. And this time, I fear that Pauline, by which I mean the United States of America, will be squashed like a bug by the crisis. And the reason that this time won't end up as happily as the other times is that we have one political party controlling all parts of government, so there's no necessity on the part of Republicans to negotiate with Democrats, as there was when President Obama was president. And we have an administration that suffers from what I think of as the three I's: inexperience, incompetence, and infighting, the three I's. And inexperience is obvious. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin wants to do the right thing, which is just a simple bill to raise the debt ceiling. But he has no experience stage managing the Congress of the United States or the legislative process, which has its own rhythms and strategies. The incompetence is sort of obvious at so many levels that there's no reason to go into that in any detail. But the infighting is extremely problematic. There are two principal figures in the administration responsible for this area. One is Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, who has been designated as the lead person, but the other is the budget director, Mick Mulvaney. And Director Mulvaney is not a neophyte. He was one of the founders of the Freedom Caucus when he was a member of Congress. And he was absolutely thrilled with the idea of creating a debt ceiling crisis for two reasons. One, so that the Freedom Caucus could accomplish its political objectives that it cannot accomplish through ordinary legislative processes because people in Congress don't agree with the agenda of the Freedom Caucus. But they believe they have the leverage in this one situation to accomplish what they can't accomplish in ordinary legislative process. And the second reason that Mulvaney believes that this is a crisis worth triggering is that he and some other people on the far right believe that the problem itself is overstated, because the government can simply exercise what they call prioritization. And that's the biggest single problem, because what it does is it's an attempt to trivialize the consequences by this completely false theory that prioritization will mean that the consequences won't be particularly severe, and therefore it's a gambit worth exploring to accomplish the legislative agenda of a fringe movement on the far right of our political spectrum.
So Mulvaney, of course, is the White House budget director. And
yes,
as you mentioned, the Freedom Caucus, better known as the Tea Party, he was one of their big stars. But the extraordinary thing that he recently said, it just really gives you an insight into the kind of aggressive ignorance and callousness of these people in this Trump administration. He said that recently that it would be great to use the debt ceiling to obtain leverage on cutting spending to the poor, principally Medicaid. Now, he makes no bones about it. Punish the poor, cut Medicaid to give the tax breaks to the Koch brothers. That's what these guys are all about. I mean, this guy's a zealot, isn't he?
Well, in my view, he's a zealot. And what's critically important, I believe, is that the Freedom Caucus, having failed to, in effect, get its way in ordinary legislative process, they failed in the health care legislation, which, as we all understand, was a tax cut for the rich financed by cutting Medicaid spending on the poor. They will fail again on the budget, and their view is that this is their opportunity to have the leverage to accomplish their agenda even though theirs is very much a minority view, even within the entirety of Congress. So that's one principal problem. Now Mulvaney has said to a handful of reporters last week that he's on board with a clean debt bill. But a lot of people don't believe that Mick Mulvaney has simply become a different kind of person overnight. And what's missing here is a president who stands up and says to an audience, I insist on a clean debt bill because I will not put the credit of the United States in jeopardy for any particular political agenda. And to say that with Mulvaney on one side of him and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin on the other. This president has not done that. I doubt that this president will do that. And I therefore, I think like many people, are skeptical that Mick Mulvaney will stick to a script, notwithstanding his remarks a couple of days ago. So we have this problem of inexperience, incompetence, and infighting, all within the same political party, which makes things actually harder. Because, for example, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, would like to stay Speaker of the House, but can he, in fact, hold on to his job if he promotes a cleaned debt ceiling bill when many Republicans feel that it's their mission in life to cut taxes on the rich and cut spending on the poor, and that this was an opportunity to do so that they didn't take advantage of. So at every level, when you try to work through the politics, things are actually worse from a political gaming perspective than they were in the Obama years. And on top of that, the prioritization crowd feels emboldened. The idea of prioritization is that when, in fact, the government defaults, that is, it cannot pay all of its bills on time, the government will prioritize payments of interest on Treasury debt, and so therefore the capital markets, the bond markets won't care. And the only people who suffer are whatever other claimants, Medicaid, federal employees, whichever ones are arbitrarily chosen, who don't get paid what they're owed. And that's just false. Not paying amounts, claims against the government that are uncontested, that are genuine claims, not paying those claims on time is default. All of these claims, whether it's Treasury interest or salary to a federal employee or whatever, all of these have the same standing in law. They're, one is not senior to the other by virtue of any legislation or by virtue of the Constitution. So prioritization is simply an arbitrary decision on the part of Treasury to create a seniority for some debt obligations over others when that does not exist in the law. Oh. And so the consequence of that, because the bond markets aren't stupid, they realize that once this administration decides to prioritize X over Y, some future administration may decide to prioritize Y over X. It is default. It will be understood as default, and therefore that's why the consequences will be so serious.
Well, Ed Kleinbaum, just to correct something, when you mentioned cutting taxes on the rich in order to punish the poor with cutting Medicaid, it's worth noting that Medicaid is the main source of payments to most Americans, including middle-class Americans, for their elderly parents and grandparents in retirement homes. It's no longer a program for the poor. So it will have pretty dire consequences right across the board, not just for the poor, but for average families and middle-class families who, without that payment from Medicaid, would find it very difficult to take care of their elderly parents and grandparents. It's just very that fundamental. But let me just go to what you were just suggesting here. these characters like Mulvaney and Tom Cole, these Republicans, these Tea Party people, always use the household analogy of the credit card and maxing out on your credit card, etc. Well, you can use the analogy that, you know, if you're late with your bills, paying your bills, you have to pay a penalty, and also it affects your credit. And they don't seem to get that this is going to affect the United States, its creditworthiness. And the one great advantage the U.S. has over any other nation on the earth is that it is the reserve currency. It's a massive advantage that they have. And anybody that screws with that is insane.
I can't disagree. The key thought is that prioritization does not mean that there's no default. It means there is default, and that markets here and internationally will understand that. They will understand that the credit of the United States has not been preferred by virtue of prioritization, but rather all of the credit of the United States has been subordinated to the whims of the political party that happens to be in control of Congress. And everything that this country has done, going back to Alexander Hamilton, to establish and maintain its preeminence as a credit-worthy sovereign, all of that is dissipated. Now, I need to correct one important thought, which is the credit card analogy. In the ordinary household, your income is fixed, and your bills may run away from you, in which case you've got a problem. For the United States of America, our income, the government's income, isn't fixed. From the government's point of view, its income is tax revenues. This is a very wealthy country. It is a very successful economy. The economy is actually doing quite well right now. And yet what you discover is that we are the lowest taxed large economy in the world as a percentage of our national income. So really what all of this is about is a Congress that is starving the spending, the government spending, that accomplishes so much for the middle class, so much for the bottom 90% of America, is starving that by not collecting the tax revenues necessary to pay the bills. So the credit card analogy is very tempting, but the difference is we have the resources as a country to raise the income, if you will, of the federal government, collecting more in tax. And so therefore, if you think that there is a fundamental imbalance between spending and government revenues, what you have to acknowledge, if you look at it, is that the problem is really on the revenue side, that we are number one in the world in whining about our tax rates, but in fact, we collect by way of tax, including state and local, by the way, less than any other big economy in the world. So those are the debates we should have, and the forum for having those debates is tax reform and the budget. The debt ceiling is just the consequence of those two things. It's a consequence of a systematic decision by Congress, which controls spending, to spend at the level that the people of the United States actually want, as your point about nursing homes makes clear, and to raise by way of tax revenues insufficient sums to pay for that. So the result is deficits. The deficits aren't going to kill us. It's not going to ruin the lives of our grandchildren. But it is a decision we've made by undertaxing ourselves today. Mm-hmm. And all that the debt ceiling means is that the congressional imperative to spend, because the executive has no authority not to spend what Congress directs it to, and the congressional imperative of how much to collect has an imbalance that we fund through government borrowing, that's all just a consequence of the underlying decisions that Congress itself has controlled. The mm-hmm. debt ceiling is not a warning from God that we are an irresponsible country, but it is a window into the irresponsibility of Congress itself.
Well, just in the last minute, Ed Kleinbart, it's very hard to figure out what's going on with this president and particularly these people like Bannon and Gawker, these crazy people he has around him who seem to have more and more whispering in his ear. He has done so much to weaken and damage the United States, getting out of the TPP, for example. China's on the rise, going back to coal, which is completely insane and antiquated and destructive for the environment, and not investing in the future, electric cars, solar and wind, which China is going to steal a march on us, and we'll be a second-class power before we know it. This is all the consequences of this man. I have no idea why he's doing it. It leads you to have conspiracy theories that maybe he is the Manchurian candidate and Putin has instructed him to weaken America. I know that sounds hyperbolic, but if this clown lets the debt ceiling collapse and the U.S. as a reserve currency, the dollar as a reserve currency, is threatened and undermined, that is would be the biggest blow to this country's power beyond belief. I mean, it would be the most massive shooting yourself in the foot, not in the foot, but in the head. Just put that in perspective for us in terms of destroying America.
Yes, this is the place where every other president, whether President Bush, President Obama, has stood up and said, I will not put the credit of the United States, which we have spent 250 years developing and protecting, I will not put that at risk. Let's get a clean debt ceiling bill done and pay our bills on time. This president has said nothing. This president has said before that he's the king of debt and that implying somehow at one point that he was going to renegotiate the treasury obligations of the United States, you know, as if we were Venezuela or something like that. If this happens, if interest rates go up, government interest rates go up by just 0.2%, which is way less than I suspect would happen, that's $400 billion over 10 years that would cost the government. $400 billion in a sense of more tax revenues to make up for this self-inflicted gunshot wound. In turn, all private borrowers will have to pay more because their borrowing is set by reference to Treasury borrowing. People whose bills aren't paid, suppliers to the government, employees of the government, whatever decision is made as to who not to pay, are going to have cash flow crises of their own that will ripple through the economy. And as I said earlier, the key thought that you have to take away is that from the point of view of the larger global capital markets, we will have demonstrated that the credit of the United States is now a captive of the political whims of the moment. And that, in turn, just by itself, means that the United States will never be able to borrow again on the same terms it can borrow today.
Well, Ed Kleinbart, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I'll be speaking with Edward Kleinbart. He's a professor of law at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law. He served as the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Governments Should Spend Our Money, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Debt Ceiling Crisis is Real. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.